From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Cities from the Gulf Coast to Sri Lanka to the Philippines are rebuilding after devastating natural disasters. What they build will shape their communities for decades to come. In this hour, we'll talk about architecture as a force for social change. We'll talk about how the Japanese are celebrating small houses.
Instead of having a lot of possessions, they're doing this Japanese simplicity. One pot, one small cabinet, one beautiful treasured object.
We'll introduce an ancient Hindu design philosophy called Vastu.
You and many of your listeners have had the experience of walking into a house and feeling uneasy, but you didn't know why. And Vastu really is the science that explains why we feel that way.
Also, the godfather of the American solar design movement makes the case for the future, solar buildings and even solar cities.
Can we bring the joy of nature into our buildings? I think that has to become a major objective of architecture.
And the man who gave the green design movement its motto, design like you give a damn.
We're not living in a world where we're all living in SUVs and muck mansions. You know, the majority of the world live in what the West calls slum settlements. You know, 1 in 7 people live in literally appalling, inadequate housing. So we need to think of housing as a basic human right.
Cameron Sinclair was only 23 when he founded Architecture for Humanity, a nonprofit charity that puts architects and designers on the front lines of disaster relief. In the 7 years it's been around, Architecture for Humanity has responded to Hurricanes Ivan, Emily, and Katrina, worked on reconstruction in India and Sri Lanka after the tsunami, cleared mines and built playgrounds in the Balkans, and designed refugee housing in Afghanistan. Through all of this, Cameron Sinclair's message to the design community has been simple. Design like you give a damn. He told Steve Paulson he's learned a lot since he first set out to build homes for refugees from Kosovo.
This was the first project that we tackled. This was back in 1999, and we looked at the idea that while many NGOs, non-governmental organizations, were looking at refugees as they were streaming out of the country, we really thought about, well, what happens once they return?
And often returning to places where they no longer have homes.
Yeah. I mean, this was a time when we were starting to learn about ethnic cleansing and the scorched earth approach, which was you go in and you kill a family and you turn on the gas and you blow up their home. You eradicate any memory of that family. Now, what we had come up with was a design competition where you would develop a sustainable transitional shelter, a shelter that would last 5 to 10 years, that a family would have on their existing plot of land, and they would live there whilst they rebuilt their own home. So this wasn't about giving replacement housing. This was giving a family the opportunity to rebuild their homes. This idea came directly from the refugees who said, listen, I know how to build. My family's been building for generations. I don't want some tent. I want to be able to just have that opportunity. And that's something that we've been working with for a long time, which is the idea of changing the policy. I can build a beautiful building that's low cost, but if I can't change the policy, then that's only one building. If you can change the policy, you can literally change the lives of millions of people.
So to be effective, you've got to work with the political system.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we've been quite fortunate, at least overseas. If there's a disaster, I call it the Google effect. If you go to Google and you put in disaster and architecture or humanitarian design, we're at the top of Google, right? I don't know how it happened, but we are. So, you know, I'll be in the greengrocers, you know, buying asparagus and my cell phone will go off. And it's a cabinet minister of a country that's just been devastated. And they say, we were just on Google. We found your website. Can you help us? You know, which is a really kind of interesting, kind of takes you back a little that you can be in the midst of doing your daily chores and you have a world leader asking you for help. Internationally, we've had a lot of support. Nationally, it's a little harder. There's a lot more red tape in this country.
In the United States?
Yes. I mean, more politicians were former lawyers. So, you know, we live in a world of litigation. So to get to that level where you can talk seriously about housing issues, you have to jump through all these hoops. And I'm sure if there's any community members out there, they know exactly what I'm talking about. But if you're dealing in a country that's just been devastated, and the need has become so great. You know, when I was in Sri Lanka, within 2 days I was sitting in the Prime Minister's office. Here, you know, it's hard to get a meeting with the mayor.
Now, we were talking earlier about refugee camps and, of course, refugees. I mean, this is an enormous problem around the world. Mm-hmm. I've heard that you've worked on compostable tent cities?
Well, all sorts of things. I mean, we're doing a project in the next year called Rethinking Tent City. 1 in 7 people live in what we call slum settlements. That's inadequate housing, refugee situations, internally displaced populations. In 25 years, it's going to be 1 in 3 people. Okay, so we're not living in a world where housing is getting better. It's going to get remarkably worse. And that the city of the future is not going to look like New York City. It's going to look like Mumbai with illegal housing everywhere. So it's become really important for us to look at this kind of tent city situation. And we've had designers from around the world come up with these crazy ideas, one of them including a housing design that's impregnated with seeds, essentially, and that you live in this shelter until you can return. And you pack up this shelter, and then you bury it underground, and your first crops of the harvest come up. Now, it seems crazy, right? It seems like a crazy idea. But if the house is deteriorating at the same time, you have this instant first aid kit. And rather than your first aid kit being a Mars bar, you actually have crops. So you can actually harvest.
Now, I've also heard about something that just sounds totally remarkable to me. And I mean, some of these places we have been war zones, and they have all kinds of landmines mm-hmm. around. I mean, of course, if you step on those, you get blown up. Mm-hmm. And apparently you can plant flowers, wildflowers, that will detect the presence of landmines?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a Copenhagen-based company that has been looking at, they've genetically modified a plant. Now, I don't like genetically modified plants, but when I heard about this, I was like, this is pretty neat. This plant, essentially, when you sow the seeds, it becomes stressed and changes color because of chemicals. And the chemicals and the gases emitted from the landmines actually make it turn red. So you can essentially plant a field, and wherever there's red, you know there's a landmine. The other project that I really love is called the Mine Wolf, which is a turnip farmer in Germany said, well, landmines are just like turnips. So he built a machine that was supposed to be used for harvesting turnips. And he essentially made it strong enough that it could withstand the blast of a landmine. And this thing just rolls over a field and picks up all these landmines and just, you know, blows them all up and gets rid of them. So actually, for me, the landmine is one of the biggest issues globally, because if you have 3 landmines and you stick them on an acre of land and a child steps on one, nobody will build on that land, no matter if there's 2 or 200 landmines, because the psychological issues associated with that are disastrous. I'm not sure what you do. I think the best thing you can do is support the demining activities that are going on around the world. The one that I really love as well is, I think it's called like Mines to Vines, which is a California-based organization that remove landmines and put in grapevines, and then they create wineries. I think it's fantastic. You know, this couple who created this essentially have created this baby industry, this small industry of wine growers around Afghanistan, you know. I'll drink Afghani wine if it helped remove landmines. So I think it's been really fascinating, some of the, you know, ideas that have cropped up out of this issue.
This is fascinating to hear sort of the ingenious ways that design can make our lives better, especially for the people who need it the most.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what you'll find if you're out in the field is the community is some of the most inventive, creative people I've ever met in my life. I mean, some of the most amazing products and buildings that have been designed and developed have happened out of developing nations. A good example of this is in South Africa. We're currently doing something that, on the outlook, looks like a very simple project, which is building a soccer field, right? This soccer field is more than a soccer field. It's an area which has the highest HIV/AIDS rate in the world. And the community came to us and they said, look, we have an issue, is that none of the young girls in our community are neither educated nor do they meet with each other and can discuss these issues. So by the time they get to the age where, you know, they get into their teens, they all get infected. And this is why, you know, this problem is getting worse and worse. We need somewhere where girls could meet. They can talk about their issues, and perhaps we can introduce healthcare. So we came up with this idea of doing a soccer field, and the soccer field is going to be run by HIV/AIDS trained nurses. They're going to be the coaches of the girls' team.
So you actually have both a healthcare facility there as well as a soccer field.
But it doesn't say healthcare facility. This is a great thing, is to break that taboo of AIDS and to really approach a community, young girls who have not been really approached before. You have to do it very softly. So we're using sports facilities as a way to do that.
So how do you make a soccer field attractive so that these girls want to go and hang out there?
You know, it's extremely easy. We put up a notice on the side of a road that said, who wants to join a soccer league? Within a couple of weeks, we had over 300 people sign up. So just the idea of having that facility within the community is extremely important. Secondly, you know, the design that is being built in South Africa is a beautiful, actually, construction that utilizes, again, local technology. It's going to be built by the community. You can go to our website and see the design. It uses landscape terraces and has awnings and a beautiful clubhouse. And, you know, essentially any football team or soccer team in the West would be extremely happy if it was their venue. But, you know, here you have 9 to 14-year-old girls who have a field of their own. They actually called the field Siathemba, which is Zulu for hope, which I thought was very nice. So this is really how design makes a difference. These aren't just, you know, our projects. There are designers throughout the country that are involved in this, and they're kind of the grassroots hidden side of design. You know, there's Brian Bell in North Carolina who has something called Design Core. There's the Rural Studio, which was Sambo Mokbi, and there's Red Feather that works on the Indian reservation. There's, you know, for every Frank Gehry, there are 100 designers in your community doing amazing work that don't want to be on the front cover of magazines.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I guess my image of, you know, young architecture students who go to school is they do want to become the next Frank Gehry. They want to put up the next fantastic art museum somewhere. But I'm sure there are a lot of people like that. But you're saying there's this whole other cadre of designers and architects who want to go out and make the world better.
You know, if you go to any design school in the country and you ask people, why did you become an architect? Okay, the top three reasons are, I want to design something that looks beautiful, right? I want to do something that helps the environment. I want to do something that really fits in the community. Okay, so you take those top three things. I want to help the environment, I want to do something in the community, and I want to do something beautiful. Right there is humanitarian design. I mean, when you go home and you watch CNN or Fox or whatever you decide to watch, and you see kind of this war and starvation and, you know, things like Darfur and tsunami, and you begin to think to yourself, well, wait a minute, all I do, if you strip away all the hype and everything, all I do is provide shelter. So why wouldn't I provide shelter to those who need it most? And this is a question that thousands of designers have asked themselves, and they've emailed us and said, can we do something? So we're just trying to act as that conduit.
Cameron Sinclair is the founder and executive director of Architecture for Humanity. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning, I'd hammer in the evening.
That's Billy Bragg's version of Pete Seeger's classic song. You could say that America's gift to 21st century architecture is the McMansion, in which case Japan's is the very small home. The hottest new design craze in fashion-conscious Japan is for houses that go beyond small to tiny. We're talking 1,000 or even 500 square feet of space for a couple or even a family of four. Sound impossible? American architect Asby Brown lives and works in Tokyo. He recently published a book of photographs of some of the best new small Japanese homes, which, he says, represent a return to the roots of Japanese housing.
Japanese homes on average were always fairly small. In the Edo period, which ended, you know, a little over 150 years ago, the average town dweller was living in about 250 square feet. They had these tiny, tiny tenements, and the entire family's living there. And that was like three-quarters of the urban population.
I mean, even for small people, that is not a lot of space. Yeah,
they were always that way. And a lot of the characteristics that distinguish the better of the houses that I'm looking at in my book, certainly they're very traditional characteristics, things like using the area under the floor for storage, putting things away. Of course, bedding was always, you know, futons, and they were always rolled up and put out of the way and making the room usable for something else. cabinets and boxes and shelves have always had a wonderful intricacy and pure functionality in Japan, nesting boxes and things that you can take out when you need them and then put them out of sight. Yeah. There's also one other very important thing that strikes me about many of these houses, and they're very, very modern in appearance, right. Very, very spare, almost, you know, minimalist. And instead of having a lot of possessions on display, you know, they're doing this Japanese simplicity and one pot, you know, one small cabinet, one beautiful treasured object, instead of having a lot of things that sort of seemed good at the time.
Well, so, it does seem to flow through all of the pictures. You look at these places
and does.
Think
it's
that
partly
the junk
selection.
In my house would fill these houses.
Right. The junk in all of our houses would, and how can you get rid of it? And that's funny, you know, because I'm not trying to, you know, do a kind of a spiritual life advice thing in this book. It's about design. It's about sort of practicality and functionality and beauty. But speaking with the various homeowners has been really, really interesting. There's one house called the Saginomiya House, which is one of the first ones in the book. And it's a two-story house. The occupant is a widow. And she's actually, you know, well off enough that she could have built almost any kind of house anywhere she wanted, but she decided she wanted this small house, which is, you know, less than 1,000 square feet, and devoted the entire first floor to a party space. And
is that the one with a 7-foot square kitchen?
That's the one. But the thing about this woman that really made me sigh was when I asked her about her closet. This house has a small walk-in closet. And I'm thinking of my own mother-in-law. They're almost an identical age, and my mother-in-law has clothes that she's kept for 30 years but doesn't wear in her closet. She has several large closets, and they're all full. And I said, well, what about you? What do you do about the clothes? And she said, oh, I give it all away every year and buy new ones. So she, not well, maybe it's she has enough money to do that, but she gives it to charity. Yeah. And keeps the few things she really likes and just avoids getting the stuff she doesn't need.
What is it about these houses that makes them feel so much larger, at least in the pictures, than the square footage would seem to indicate that they are?
I'd say the technique that has the most impact in that respect is what I'd call the soft division of space. The architects have found ways to separate the different areas in these homes without building walls necessarily. Many of them are of the nature of a large open room with some raised floor area for perhaps a dining area or a kitchen, some part that has suddenly a tall but narrow atrium over it, and that is sort of delineating a particular place to sit in the living room. I see the use of quite a lot of curtains, lighting that both lends an identity to the areas, makes it clear, you know, what they're for, and also activates the space, makes it feel less confined because the light is moving through and playing off the walls, etc.
Well, there's some interesting things that they do with light. Mm-hmm. There's one that I remember a picture of what looks like a cupboard on the wall, but the light must be behind it. It looks almost as though the box
that's
is floating.
Right. I believe that's the Ambiflux house, which is a very unusual house.
Now, that's the tall, skinny one, right?
The tall, skinny one. Is that the one we're thinking of?
And I
think the cupboards.
So, yeah.
In the living area, yes, they have a lighting concealed behind it, and it has sort of a dual thing. Plus, the way the architect designed it, these cupboards seem to be floating. When the lights are on, it's like it's almost like a little science fiction movie, you know, this hovering box, you know, filled with shoes on one side.
Yeah. That Ambiflux house is interesting in other ways, I think. It's tall and skinny. Floor space, and I suppose you get it, it's like rooms stacked one on top of another.
That's right. It looks more like what we call a pencil building in Japan, where the lot is only, you know, about 30 feet across. As development has proceeded in the Japanese city, you know, they've built up, but the lots are still very narrow. And in fact, the two lower floors are rental space. One has, I think, a shoe shop in it, and the other one is some kind of gallery. You enter actually from what's the third floor, and when you go in, there's an atrium that goes up, you know, four stories. It's spectacular. There's beautiful, light, cantilevered stairs that climb the walls. It's like a medieval tower in some ways, but reinterpreted in modern terms. And, of course, the family has children, and they're running up and down these stairs. It's a couple of lovely daughters, and they're running up and down. I'm sure they're getting a lot of exercise. And all of the rooms are open to this atrium. There's no real walls, you know, separating the bedroom, etc. And the light comes from the skylight, which is the entire ceiling. I mean, the whole
thing is combine all to pull your eyes up so you don't concentrate on how little floor space there is.
And, you know, exactly. You don't feel the walls.
We were talking about lighting in some of these houses. They have used lighting in ingenious ways. There's one, isn't there, that has translucent walls?
That's right. That is a house called Natural Wedge, designed by Masaki Endo. And this is one of the interesting houses in terms of structure. This house is based on a steel trusswork. It's a beautiful, delicate, sculptural thing, white-painted, delicate trussing all through the house and including the walls, which are sheathed in glass. Of course, at nighttime, the entire house is illuminated like a lantern. It's beautiful, but the walls are glass. And, of course, not transparent. It's translucent. And, you know, to make glass walls, you know, and have the light come through, then you have to think about a lot of other things, such as insulation. The architect spent a bit of energy hunting down appropriate materials that were translucent. He found a kind of polyester fiber fill that's in a kind of nylon sheathing, all of which is translucent. So that's what's inside the walls. It's a remarkable house, like a giant wedge, and light comes in from every side, and it makes you feel like you're floating.
You've talked about the materials that are used and the ways in which houses are stacked and about how things flow outside. There's another house I was fascinated by that essentially has one wall that looks to be removable.
That's right. The Engawa House, yes, it's a very wonderful house. It's essentially a large rectangular box, and the interior is totally free of obstructions. And one side of the house faces a garden, which is bounded on the opposite side by the parents' home. So the couple wanted to build a house to make a family compound, and both houses would share this garden. And what the architects did was make one wall completely openable by means of, you know, fairly conventional, you know, heavy-duty sliding glass doors. There's about a dozen of them, which, you know, slide back to open this wall. And the house is, you know, again, less than 1,000 square feet. It's about 845 square feet. And this family, you know, this is something I've noticed, that many of the houses have not included sofas and those kind of living room furnishings, but center their life around a table. And this house has a remarkable table that's about 10 feet long. And all the family life takes place around that table. It's really, really beautiful. Wow. And it fits with the house very, very, very nicely.
What of all this has changed the way you think about design as an American who spent a lot of time in Japan now?
Well, what has been very interesting is to see the interest on the part of Americans and others from Europe, and I've even had interest from Hong Kong, etc. People seem to be ready to rethink their lifestyle a bit and to question the megalomania that's driving this phenomenon of McMansions and maximizing the size of everything. I find it very nice to be in a small little cozy room with a good book, and that book becomes my entire environment when I'm in it. And I think that kind of beautiful mental space is probably the most central requirement for really living in a small house. And I think a lot of Americans would be able to appreciate this kind of lifestyle as well.
Esby Brown runs the Future Design Institute in Tokyo. He's the author of The Very Small Home, Japanese Ideas for Living Well in Limited Space. Next, an ancient Hindu philosophy of home design enjoys a comeback. Practitioners of Vastu call it yoga for the house. We'll find out more when we come back. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Seven 7,000 years ago, Hindu philosophers and holy men created a science of building, a philosophy for designing homes and temples in harmony with the subtle energies of the universe. Today, well, move over feng shui and make way for Vastu. In Chicago, Seattle, even Washington, D.C., office buildings designed according to Vastu are going up. In almost any major American city, you can now find a Vastu consultant who will tell you how to move your furniture, or your walls and windows. to balance your home. Robin and Michael Mastro are two of the best-known Vastu consultants on the West Coast. Robin's an interior designer and Michael's an architect. And Strainchamps asked him about one of his better-known clients.
Michael, didn't you design an office building for Microsoft?
Yes, the very first building that they occupied in Bellevue, I designed that and built it as well, and around the principles of Vastu.
Did Bill Gates know you were trained in Vastu, or was that just something extra you brought to the job?
Yeah, it was basically something extra. At that time, I didn't really talk about it a lot. I first became acquainted with Vastu in the late 60s, early 70s, when I was designing some buildings for Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who was the Beatles guru. And he taught me the very basic principles of this ancient science. And then I utilized them in a lot of buildings that I've built.
Do you think that original office had anything to do with their success?
Well, they've done very well. It's obvious.
So for those of us who've never heard of Vastu, what is it?
Vastu is a 7 to 10,000-year-old science of architecture that was developed in India over many thousands of years by men of great knowledge. What they're called rishis in Sanskrit. And what they did was observe how environments affect consciousness.
Is Vastu related at all to the Chinese art of feng shui?
The goal of Vastu and feng shui is the same, to have energy, life force energy, known as qi in China and prana in India, to move freely throughout a structure, a home or an office, so that it does not get stuck. Stuck energy creates stress, and we all know what stressful environments feel like.
You've worked with a lot of Western clients. That notion that there's an energy force that can run through buildings is a pretty big leap of faith for Westerners. What have you found are the best ways of trying to talk about this with Westerners?
Well, everything is a living organism. Everything is made of energy. We're all familiar with solar energy and magnetic energy. Electricity. We can't see these things, but they're there, and we definitely feel their effects, and through technology we see what results they can bring. Hmm. A really good example is how we sleep. Positive magnetic energy comes from the north, and our bodies are like a magnet with the positive polarity in the head. If you, for example, sleep with your head in the north direction, it's like bringing two positive ends of magnets together. What happens? They repel. And this is exactly what happens in the body when we sleep with our head in the north. Our digestion, our circulation, everything gets disturbed because of this repelling force.
It's one of those things over time that can make a difference in what goes on with your body. In India, they bury people with their heads to the north.
And this is because the body has been known to decompose more quickly when your head is to the north, buried in that direction. They've done a lot of studies in hospitals showing the effects of healing and which direction you sleep and how certain directions promote quicker healing.
Now, what do you do when you walk into somebody's house and you say, oh my God, your bed is totally facing the wrong way. You've got to, you know, move this and see if it'll work. And they say, but there isn't any other place in the room where it'll look good.
That's a great question. And we have hundreds of clients with that situation. And what we ask them to do is, if the bed cannot go any other direction, just sleep on the other end of the bed. And a lot of beds now are designed in a sleigh fashion with kind of a small headboard on each end. So it works out well for a lot of people.
Huh. So when you walk into somebody's house, I mean, do you need to look at the compass and figure out where north and south and east and west are? Or do you just walk in and immediately start thinking, whoa, there's something seriously wrong here?
I can feel it. I can feel it blindfolded because I've been doing this for the past 30 years. But the first thing I do is I walk around the lot and check for geopathic stress and
the
shape of the lot.
What's geopathic stress?
Geopathic stress is underground streams, utilities, fault lines, and these carry radiation. And wherever these lines cross within a home, and often we find it's on someone's bed, that radiation builds up. And when radiation builds up in a place in a home where someone spends a lot of time, it will break down their immune system and eventually lead to dis-ease in the body. Could be cancer, could be a lot of different things. So we check for that and block that.
How do you block it?
We utilize copper, which is a grounding agent. It's interesting, many European countries, France, Germany, Austria, it's a requirement before you build a structure to check for geopathic stress and find a way to deal with it.
Can you do Vastu on a much vaster kind of plane? For instance, can you look at the United States, at the country's major buildings, and say something about the country's health?
Yes, and that's a whole other discussion. But one small example is the White House. Where you place water has a certain effect, and it can be very, very positive, very life-supporting, or have the opposite effect. And the White House actually has a fountain, a water body on the south, and that is actually balanced by the Washington Monument, that tall, heavy structure there. And people that I actually learned Vastu from have indicated that if that was not there, it would have a very, very negative impact on the United States.
Is there any Vastu significance, then, to the loss of the World Trade Center towers?
That's a very, very interesting question. And yes, there are some specific design tenets in Vastu. And when you build a very, very tall building in a monolithic type structure where it does not reduce in length and width as it rises,
it doesn't get smaller at the top.
Right. It has a definite negative effect. An alternate example is the Twin Towers of Kuala Lumpur. They're designed very much per Vastu, where they rise in a rhythmic nature and get smaller as they come up to the top, which is more in harmony with nature. So there's a lot of things about the Twin Towers, and I don't like to offend people. I know a lot of people, families lost their families' lives there, so I don't like to talk about it too much. But it definitely was designed against nature, and the ultimate effect can be attributed to that.
Michael and Robin Mastro talking with Anne Strangechamps. The Mastros run a Vastu consulting firm in the Seattle area. Their book on the subject is called The Way of Vastu. There are a lot of things we might learn from ancient architects. Before air conditioning and central heating and electric light, people who built houses knew a lot more about designing with nature than we do. They paid attention to the transit of the sun, to the cardinal directions, to the seasonal rhythms of light and dark. They built green houses long before anyone coined the term. Today, architects and urban planners are rediscovering what our ancestors took for granted. Ralph Knowles is one of the godfathers of the modern green design movement. He founded the University of Southern California's Solar Studio and taught there for many years. Now retired, he's just published his 9th book on green design, called Ritual House, Drawing on Nature's Rhythms. Steve Paulson asked him, why go to so much trouble? Why not just air condition everything?
Interesting question. Why not? Why not air condition everything? And the answer, of course, is, if we don't learn somehow to connect our buildings to the basic rhythmic changes of nature, I think we're in big trouble. We've got two things going here. One is an enormous shortage and potential shortage of energy. The other is population growth. In 1950, only New York and all the world had 10 million people. By the year 2000, the number of cities was up around 15 or so that had 10 million or more. And one of those had 20 million, Tokyo. By 2015, there will be 25 cities in the world of 10 million or more, 6 to 9 of those of 20 million. So we've got these twin pressures of a lack of security of our energy supplies and a growing urban population. So how cities use energy is going to determine how most energy in the world will be used. We've got to learn somehow to adapt the growth of these cities to use the sun as a source of energy. It's, after all, available to us at latitudes all the way from far northern Europe, which is at 50 degrees north, to 50 degrees south, and every major city in the world lies within that band. There are countries that are moving much faster than we are. Germany, for example, has what they call a solar cities movement, in which whole cities are adapting the ideas, the planning procedures, the policies, and the design procedures to use the sun as a source of energy.
So what are some of the ideas being tossed around about how to use sun more effectively in the design of cities?
Well, the first thing you need, of course, is solar access for buildings. And I've been working for years on an idea called a solar envelope, which represents the largest volume you can put on a building site without overshadowing your neighbor. It's essentially a requirement for zoning that limits the height and shape of buildings so as not to overshadow your neighbor during a useful energy-receiving time of the day and year.
And many architects in previous centuries understood these principles. I mean, you write about the great churches of Western Europe and how they were designed with the sun's progression in mind.
I think there are two things about that. One is, they didn't have mechanical systems, no air conditioning, and so on, so that they had to somehow learn to live with the elements. The other aspect of that is, if you learn to live with the elements, and you do learn, you're responding not to a fixed condition. The sun does not stand still in the sky. The winds do not blow constantly from one direction at a given rate. They change, and they tend to change rhythmically, and therefore predictably. So what the Gothic architects were doing was responding, for example, to sunlight coming through stained glass windows, entering the nave, entering the transept. Going back to the geometry of the sun, in the wintertime, the sun is coming low from the southern sky. So they opened the west windows of the nave to that low winter sun. The summer sun is high in the sky, so it barely gets in. So they were responding to that basic rhythm, a seasonal rhythm of the sun, primarily in the nave of the church, where the transept catches the morning light from one side and the afternoon light from the other side. So there was a basic diurnal rhythm that was at work in the transept. They learned to use the rhythmic ways that the sunlight entered those great cathedrals to enhance the quality of the space and to reinforce the rituals that were going on in the church.
Well, it makes you wonder how we respond to that emotionally. I mean, especially given the whole sense of ritual that's so powerful in a church like a Gothic cathedral.
Sure. I've thought a lot about that. I've sat for long periods of time in cathedrals to watch the sun move, to watch it move differently in the different spaces. And I finally decided that while a tourist is not going to appreciate that, the people who live there, who spend time in that church, who come back maybe daily or certainly they come back weekly or monthly, they're going to be aware on some level. They may not be able to describe it to you, but surely they're going to feel it, and it's going to affect their, not just their bodies, it's going to affect their souls.
And didn't the Native American cliff dwellers in the Southwest also have a fairly sophisticated sense of solar design?
Yeah, they certainly did. If you look at something like Mesa Verde, there are many south-facing caves at Mesa Verde, and what happens is that the low winter sun enters under the brow of that cave and heats and lights the cave in the wintertime. In the summertime, the sun, as I said before, is high in the sky and it doesn't get into the cave. So you have a natural air conditioning system in the summertime and a natural heating system in the wintertime. That principle can be applied to buildings. We can design buildings that absorb the heat in wintertime from the sun and that keep it out in the summertime. So these are basic principles that we've got to employ. In many cases, we've got to relearn them. They've been around for centuries and centuries, thousands of years, really.
So for those of us who are not architects or urban planners, what do we do with this kind of thinking if we want to incorporate nature's rhythms more into our own lives?
Part of that, I think, is, as all things educational, schools of architecture have to start thinking about adaptations to nature other than bigger heaters and bigger coolers. We've got to learn how to design with nature And it's for two basic reasons. One is energy. And I think the other is a less well understood and less talked about aspect of it, and that is the quality of life. Can we bring the joy of nature into our buildings? I think that has to become a major objective of architecture. We've spent now decades in admiration for the machine and machine building and machine living. I think what we're now experiencing is a rejection of that. And the question is, what comes next? If we reject the modern movement, postmodern movement, the deconstruction movements, all of these styles that isolated us from nature, if we reject those things, where do we go? And the answer has to be that we have to relearn how to live with nature. There could be many ways to do it, and there will be many answers to that, but it's the next big task.
Ralph Knowles is Professor Emeritus at the University of Southern California School of Architecture. He's written 9 books on solar design. The most recent is called Ritual House, Drawing on Nature's Rhythms. Steve Paulson spoke with him. When we come back, what can science tell you about how to arrange the furniture? You'd be surprised. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Have you ever had the experience of being out of sync with your home? Out of sync. I mean, you open your front door and you trip over a jumble of boots and hockey sticks. Or you look at your living room and realize your grandmother would be very comfortable in it, but you aren't. Or your friends suggest there might be a more original color choice for your walls, something other than white. The problem, of course, is that it's one thing to buy a house. It's quite another to make it a home. Well, science writer Winifred Gallagher has come to the rescue of those of us who are decor-challenged. In her new book, House Thinking, she writes that behavioral and environmental science can teach us quite a lot about how to make a house a home. Gallagher collected the best of this advice and along the way rethought her own home, room by room.
The first thing that really struck me was the entry, and I think this is a problem for a lot of us. The entry to your home should be a very, very special place. So what a good entry to a home should say is you have now left the mad, wild, crazy world behind you, and you are entering this wonderful private refuge. And what a lot of our entries say, I'll talk about two different types. In the city, people who live in apartments or smaller houses don't have a lot of space. And the entry to their homes tends to be a dumping ground. It's where the recycling goes and the rubber boots and the kids' backpacks. And it's the exact opposite of the message that you want to send to yourself and to your friends when they enter your home. Now, in the suburbs, and most Americans do live in the suburbs, it's a car culture. And suburban houses, all of them, have nice front doors with often a nice entry hall and maybe some pretty appointments in the hall. But the only person who ever sees it is maybe the UPS man, because everybody else drives up the driveway, often right smack into the garage. So here's your entry experience to your home. You drive into the garage, you get out of your car, you open a metal utility door that goes into the laundry room that leads you to the kitchen. This is hardly saying I've left the mad, stressful world behind and I'm now in my wonderful sheltering private refuge.
Well, let's move on. I don't want to spend the entire time in the entryway to your house. Where do you go next? Most of us, I suppose, would go straight into the living room. Is that true for
you,
too?
That's right. Yep, that sure is. And the living room is the most expressive, the most personal room in the house. Even in very simple houses in early colonial America or in parts of the third world still, where people, if they have two rooms, one of them is the room for good. So it's an important place for you to express to yourself and to your friends and family who you are, where you came from, and what you value. That's all kind of on display in the living room, in the kinds of things that we put there, whether it's bronze baby shoes or, you know, a nice painting or a collection of pottery that you pick up over your vacation. Second, it's a social room. It's a room that should say, in our home, we welcome friends and family. We value people more than televisions. If I could wave my magic wand doing psychological renovations of American homes, really the main thing I would do, if not banish the television set from the living room, at least put it off to one side and down low so that the living room doesn't look like a church where the television is the altar and you're all lined up in front of it worshiping the great God of TV.
Right, where it's not the main thing
that's
there.
Sitting there staring at a flickering screen. It's the place where you should be talking to people and curled up with a book maybe, or yeah, watch television, sure, but don't make it the focus of your room.
The same sort of thing happens when I look through magazines, and we do, you know, we look at our house and we look then in magazines and see pictures of kitchens, for instance, that look so appealing until you begin to think about what they would actually be like if you were to use them. They're huge, and places that look like you could put a whole restaurant staff in them.
Well, yeah, a restaurant-caliber kitchen is now a big, big status symbol in America. It's sort of like back in my youth in the 60s, maybe it was having like a big Cadillac or something like that. Now it's having a restaurant-style kitchen. And the funny thing about those kitchens is that we are now actually cooking radically fewer meals than we used to, and eating at home much less than we used to. Even when we do eat at home, a lot of the things are like it's a chicken that you pick up that's already been roasted or takeout. So our kitchens, again, are becoming more and more elaborate, more and more expensive, the less and less we're actually cooking. Frankly, for an awful lot of people, they don't even really need a kitchen anymore. They can get by here in New York City. There are lots of people who don't really have kitchens. They have a little mini fridge. They have a microwave for heating up their takeout. They don't entertain at home. They go to restaurants. For lots of people, that big room that you're talking about could actually kind of send them on a guilt trip, you know, like I have this big I have friends who have like gorgeous, gorgeous kitchens that are ready for the photo shoot, and they feel they never cook, and it makes them feel kind of guilty.
Well, having talked about living rooms and kitchens, I was surprised to discover that you're such an enthusiast about dining rooms. In fact, you even have a chapter heading that says, "How can your dining room help you live longer?"
The dining room was actually invented. It's kind of a Victorian invention that people dreamed up as a way of displaying status. People were spending more time socializing. This was in England. Social life gravitated around the country house. So people came and they had much more leisure time, and they were sitting around having these long meals. So they said, well, we better have like a really nice room to do that in, and let's get some nice silver and dishes and glassware and things to sort of show off to our friends and make the room beautiful. And what research shows now, actually, we don't like to think of ourselves as being attracted to status symbols, but status is a good predictor of your longevity. So that people who, for example, a very, very serious British epidemiologist did some research that showed that people who live in zip codes that are in quote-unquote better neighborhoods actually live a couple of years longer than people with the same socioeconomic profile otherwise who live in a different zip code. Here's a really fascinating little tidbit. Academy Award winners live longer than Academy Award nominees. So there seems to be, and primate evidence shows this too, the high-status individuals actually have better health. They have lower stress levels. So if you can use your dining room in your home, I'm not talking about being snobby or, you know, keeping up with the Joneses or
just use to show off things that you take satisfaction in.
Yeah, and use nice things that remind you that these rituals are important and that you deserve the best. And, you know, why not? I live in New York, so I can pick up fabulous flowers now on any street corner for $5 or $6. This isn't a big deal. We don't have to, like, wait for Valentine's Day to have flowers on the table.
You know, you're absolutely right. And I think stopping for flowers is one of the nicest things one can do. But I also
absolutely
have to tell you that I never buy fresh flowers to go into the basement. And I'm perfectly happy in the basement.
Yeah, I'm not too keen on the basement myself, but it's my husband's favorite space in the house. He's crazy about it.
A very fascinating
psychologist, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, the researcher who coined the term flow for optimum human experience, gave a lot of his research subjects beepers, and he would beep them randomly throughout the day, and they would have to record what they were doing, where they were, and how they felt. And he found that men were happiest in the basement, because for a lot of men, it's kind of their place. They don't have to take any instructions from their companions. And it's a place where that he might have a workbench or keep his tools or, you know, do other things that guys like to do. Women, it was their least favorite part of the house. Women, in Csikszentmihalyi's study, were happiest in the bathroom.
In the bathroom?
And as the mother of five kids, I can really understand that one. It is often the only room in a home that has a locking door. So when the world is too much with you, you can go into the bathroom, lock the door, run a tub, and no one can can bother you for that magic 10 minutes.
And you have to be careful with them, too. I don't know whether you have run across anything like this. I just decided recently when I was in a store buying, I've forgotten what we were there for, a laundry basket or something, but I saw one of those fog-free mirrors. Mm-hmm. And decided I would put it up in the shower so that I could shave while standing there with the hot water pouring over me, which sounded like a really nice idea. I discovered it's not all that nice, actually, to see yourself when you're in the shower, however.
Bingo. Exactly. I think there's a strong correlation between the rise of our self-monitoring technology and the rise in things like anorexia, bulimia, body dysmorphic disorder. We have to remember that for most of history, until really relatively recently, people didn't have things like bathroom scales. Until the late 19th century, mirrors were very unusual. People didn't have them. So people just simply couldn't obsess about the way they looked. I'm in my 50s. Do I want to, it's the first thing in the morning, walk into the bathroom and look at a magnifying mirror? I really don't. Not before I have some coffee.
No,
So there's no reason why we have to turn our bathrooms into these laboratories filled with equipment. They really should be, you know, private sanctuaries where we can kind of relax and take care of ourselves.
Makes sense to me. Winifred Gallagher is a science writer and journalist. You'll find more of her thoughts about how to make a house feel right in her book, House Thinking, a room-by-room look at how we live.
This old house is a-getting shaky. This old house is a-getting old. This old house lets in the rain. This old house lets in the cold. Oh, his knees are a-getting chilly, but he feels no fear of pain, 'cause he sees an angel peeking through a broken window pane.
Ain't gonna need this house no longer. Ain't gonna need this house no more.
Ain't got time to fix the shingles. Ain't got time to fix the floor. Ain't got time to oil the hinges nor to mend the window pane. Ain't gonna need this house no longer. He's getting ready to meet the saints.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To order a copy of this show, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for Design Like You Give a Damn, show number 226A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio.
PRI, Public Radio International.